Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session. And welcome back to another day of quarantined Fright School. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Joshua.
How are you doing?
You know what? I'm having a good day today. Today Wonderful. Is a good day.
Good, good, good. You look good. I love this. We are not in the same room, dear listener, but we are on a FaceTime so we can see all of our faces. Joe's face, my face, and of course our lovely guest for the day, playwright extraordinaire, wonderful writer, human being, and Joe's new best friend in his podcast world on MFK Ultimate, the lovely Delia.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Hi.
Good.
Oh, hi. I'm so happy to see you.
I know. It's so good to see everyone in their homes.
Right.
Yes. In our own little spaces.
6 feet
apart. I like we all have like the same like kind of view. Like I can see a corner in your room, a corner in Joe's room. There's a corner. It's like all angled up. It's lovely. It's lovely.
We had to create some depth.
That's how I look fantastic. Shoot me up.
I was just being comedically passive aggressive. I actually adore Delia, and so I'm so happy that you're finally been able to join us.
I know. Where are you? So many co-hosts. I'm actually in my parents' house right now, and my stepdad Remus is a musician, and he has a recording studio, and this is in Las Vegas.
Very cool.
Yeah, so I'm looking around at a lot of musical equipment that I'm never going to be inclined to use because I'm not musical in any way. But it's nice being surrounded by it.
Remus, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So it's a nice quiet space. Well lit.
Yeah, well lit. Good acoustics.
Good acoustics. Yeah.
I was like, I'm looking at it and I'm like, I know that you don't own all this electronic shit.
Girl, I can barely switch on my computer. Of course I don't own this.
All right.
That's hilarious. Shoot, I had another question and then it left my brain. That drives
Dang
me nuts.
It,
yeah, I hate that. It was something that you were saying, but that's okay. So how's everybody enjoying this ongoing pandemic, you know?
Gosh. So far, I've gotten a lot of reading and writing done. So,
hey,
and a
boom.
Lot of organizing of stuff. So I
what complain. What kind of stuff are you writing right now? What are you working on?
I am working on, let's see, a lot of personal essays, nice. Some short stories, some things I'd like to turn into like short episodic YouTube type series. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, a lot of dialogue work. Some film script ideas. Yeah, actually taking like notebooks that are labeled ideas and going ahead and actually working on them.
That I have the same scraps of things everywhere. That's like, maybe I should develop this, or maybe I'll just continue to dream and think about what it could be if I developed it.
And put it in a basket labeled ideas.
Very cool. What about reading? What are you reading?
Right now I'm reading Elizabeth Gilbert's City of Girls. It's her new fiction book, and it's about 1940s New York, and it's just so beautiful. I just love that time, and it's set in a theater that's kind of falling apart, and they put on a show. I'm like, oh my God.
I was like, who doesn't love that?
I'm like looking at Joe's face. I'm like, Joe's right up your alley. Just saying.
If he read.
So I often, I don't read. I often get confused, or I mix up Elizabeth Gilbert and Brené Brown.
Oh, okay. They look strikingly similar. Yeah, I can
see that. I mix them up because I'm just like, you know, white women and like they all do.
We all look the same.
They're like, aura is like interchangeable depending on which friend is talking about which author. It's like, she's amazing, life-changing work, and I'm like, is it Elizabeth Gilbert
or Brené?
It's just
fun
like
trivia game.
Is it, that's my favorite one. Is it, is this Brie Larson, Allison Brie, or Allison Pill?
Oh, that would be
that's a good one.
Yeah.
Or Dylan McDermott or Dermot Mulroney, as I think that was an SNL sketch.
Yes. That is brilliant, Joe. I think you have something there for
like another podcast.
Yes, right. Exactly. Are we talking about
he's Dylan polyamorous? And that's fine. It's fine. It's good to be open. Room for lots of people. Lots of poets, you know, in his heart and on his hard drive.
In my heart.
In my heart.
I hate that we're all like kind of trapped and can't go out and see concerts and do stuff, you know, but obviously want people to stay safe, want people to stay, you know, healthy, obviously. But I am enjoying everybody going like online and doing stuff, you know, doing live shows, mm-hmm. live classes. I just did a workshop with Lydia Yuknovich, who
I was going to say with Elizabeth Gilbert or Brene Brown.
Lydia Yuknovich, she's the other one.
White woman.
She writes these incredible pieces of work that are just really just dig down into the body and into, you know, living and so it was so cool to like just, you know, take this neat workshop, and it was talking about writing like literary narrative helixes, you know, kind of where you have like a piece you're writing that has two distinct parts that you weave together.
Oh, okay. Uh-oh. I was like, you're going to have to explain. I've been writing a while and still shit surprises me.
Yeah, but it's neat because I've been taking this like memoir class, this creative nonfiction class. And so I've been, you know, trying to find different ways to talk about like my mom and grief and all of that. And it was kind of it put this idea in my head. I want to write this piece about like the mythology of owls in different cultures, because my mother loved owls and she collected them. And so I wanted to write about her love of owls, but then like blending it with like these different mythologies and how they're like, and the different ways that I now in hindsight see why they attracted her. For like all these different, you know, there's different interpretations across the globe of what their meaning is. And I was like, oh, this is such a cool, like it has like a name, like the narrative helix.
The narrative helix. Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. It was just a really kind of a cool thing.
Very nice. I love that idea too of, you know, I think that's how I got through, 'cause 17 years ago this March, we had two significant family deaths back to back, like 9 days apart. And then my brother also was in Iraq. And every March, like, there's just this kind of like body shutdown that happens because it just was such like a visceral, I think in order to protect your psyche, you kind of go to another place and your body is just like, we're in shutdown mode, only essential functions. Like, so it happens like to a lesser degree every year, but the way I got through that time was writing about it. Yeah, and that's absolutely how I learned to write. Like, that's how I learned like how to put feelings into words. And there is something so universal, obviously, about grief and love. And so to put that together, like to remember your mom that way, is very powerful.
Yeah, well, because it gets to be personal and universal at the same time, you know, because everybody can relate, you know, and the same. I'm so grateful that I had this class because it started, my mother died back in October, and this class started in February, you know, so there was like a few months of just, you know, being in it, and now I'm processing a lot, and it's been like this great, great gift. Speaking of, you talked about your brother, you wrote a play, Disappearing Act.
I did.
And it's beautiful. And I'm wondering, is it published anywhere?
It is not published anywhere. And I was actually published. I wrote an essay about that time. And that came out in Incoming Sex, Drugs, and Copenhagen, which is published and is available on Amazon. And there's a lot of different essays from both veterans and kind of veteran adjacent folk such as myself who went through it, but not in the same way as being like in country. So that essay has been published, and I'm looking at doing something with Disappearing Act, but it is kind of one of those things. It's almost like, oh, I don't know if I can go back at it. You know, it's just kind of, it's because to get it out the first time was such like it took a lot. So to go back to it is, it's going to be significant. But I'd like to get it out there for wider audiences, definitely.
Yeah, if nothing else, just to read. Like, I would love to read it again because it was just beautiful. And the way it was staged, I really do think that it was well done. You know, I don't know, you know, obviously how people feel about their work and all of that kind of thing. But I just thought it was really well put together. And so, I wish it was available at least to read because it was beautiful. It was a very, very beautiful work.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, definitely shout out to Intermission Productions and Kim Pappas, who directed, and Carla Nell, who produced, and the cast that was a part of it. It was, sitting next to my family and actually watching it happen, like, it just was one of the most surreal moments. And having it well-received by veterans, like, we had a group of veterans that came to watch it, and that was my biggest fear, is that you come off sounding like kind of, I guess, hollow or like just a little bit off in the portrayal of things. But they were definitely like, yeah, you pretty much nailed it. Like, awesome. How like gunfire happens, how it sounds, the reaction of people. So I'm like, okay, well, that was all just me listening to my brother talk about war. So yeah.
Well, it is amazing. So hopefully you're able to get it out there.
Light a fire under my ass, this pandemic, and your encouragement.
All right. So what else? Has everybody watched Tiger King yet?
I have not. Okay. I have not watched that trash. I'll have to.
We talked a little bit. So we had a lot of fun on Friday. We had a happy hour with it was like a Horror Hound happy hour with the wonderful women of Jersey Ghouls and Mise en Scream, along with Katie of Mise en Scream's husband, Zach. We had this fun just online happy hour, which we're going to hopefully do again soon. It was a lot of fun. And so we talked a little bit about Tiger King. So I was curious if others had seen it. So you don't have to watch it, you know, but if you find yourself bored, it will suck you
right
in. I mean, I was like, it was like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning. I was like, oh, I'll just start watching this. And then I was stuck all day.
You're like, so that's today.
Yeah. It's 7 episodes, 45 minutes each. They flew by. It was like 1 o'clock all of a sudden. I'm like, oh, wow. Well, I'm done with that. That was quite a ride. And it is like every episode you're like, what the fuck? What?
That is what I've heard by everybody.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it's like an ode to like the mediocrity of white people or I don't know. It's very interesting.
Mediocre whiteness.
Yes. All right. Well, then what are we watching, Joe? What's going on in your life over there?
Well, I'm still making my way through Sabrina the Teenage Witch, the original. TGIF production.
Wait, is that Melissa Joan Hart? Is that who that
Melissa
is?
Melissa Joan Hart. Yeah. That's right.
What inspired you to go back and watch that?
Well, I wanted something comforting and mindless.
Fair enough. So, nailed
and
it.
And I have to tell you, it does not
magical,
hold up.
Magical.
I want to say magical too, and it does not hold up, guys. It does not hold up.
It has a ridiculous puppet cat, and no shame on puppets, but that cat, is like, oof, girl. our effects were only that good in, like, what was it, 90, 92, 90?
97.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, oh. It was 96. Yeah. It was like 96 when it started, but I have to like it is in the parts where it doesn't hold up, it really doesn't. Like, there's some transphobic things, there's homophobia, misogyny.
Wow.
Like, there was a scene where
find all this obvious oddly comforting, or like,
well, no,
you
just don't remember
going.
It's nice to go back and like be like, oh, this is bad. There's a scene where Hilda and Zelda go to like a beauty store in the other realm, and it's like run by this like caricature of a Vietnamese nail lady, and she's all like, oh, hello, you want some more? And just like throwing things in their bag, being extra pushy. And then in the same scene, Hilda takes a mint that is like no samples is what it says. No samples. She takes a mint and samples one anyway, and she gets turned into a little person. And then there's like a little person there, and then there's a bunch of and I'm like, oh my God, there's like two horrible things in this one scene. And then the recurring character of Roland, who is also a little person, who's like infatuated with Sabrina, and like saying like, yeah, I live under a bridge, and like lots of stuff, calling him like a troll. Like, it's bad.
Wow.
It's bad. But again, like,
but he's still enjoying the rewatch.
But oddly comforting.
I can't stop. I can't, because like there's also parts where I'm very clear about where I stopped watching. So it's like interesting to start from the beginning, see things that I remember, and then discover episodes that I'd never seen. And like, oh, so that's when they did this, and that informs the narrative in this place and that place. And yeah, because I was one of those like TGIF kids who, you know, every Friday night was there in front of the
TV. Family Matters, Step by Step.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also finished a couple of other shows. I finished AJ and the Queen, finally.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, what's that about?
Right, I was going to say, your voice is like, meh.
No.
It's RuPaul's show on Netflix. Okay. Where he plays a down on her luck drag queen who's over $100,000 gets stolen by a con artist boyfriend, and she's like on her way, working her way across the country to get some, you know, to earn money back, and somehow has like a stowaway on her trailer of this like little kid named AJ who ends up acting as her bodyguard.
Huh,
now,
okay.
This is the most
and manager
acting,
and like everything. It's
everything. And this is the most acting that we've seen from RuPaul in ever.
Ever.
And I was like, you know what? It's all right. Like, it's not the best. It's not going to get a second season. It ended at season one. It's not the best. But it is. I was like, oh, this is all right. This is a decent show. So. And there were some heartwarming moments with RuPaul where I'm like, oh my God, I believe you're acting. I believe you're real. and then the other show I watched was Hentified on Netflix as well.
Hentified?
I've not seen that one.
No.
Yeah, so it's a half hour like sitcom, dramedy, I guess. It's about three cousins and their grandfather who operates a mom and pop taco shop in Boyle Heights. And it's them struggling to make rent and dealing with the whole ongoing theme is gentrification. And
that sounds delightful and fun.
I know.
And it's it's interesting because it's like, it's how do you, they're trying to make rent and he's like resisting. The grandfather is open to like new ideas if it means that he gets to keep the shop. Okay. And one of the grandsons is like trying to train to be like a classically trained chef. So he's like saying, we need to bring in new types of food and have a, you know, feature taco and this and that. And then you have a very queer love story with the granddaughter who is like this artist who's very like Chicanx person, but like is also benefiting from gentrification, which I thought was really interesting.
Oh.
So like she's all about like, you know, I'm speaking for my people, but at the same time, like directly benefiting from gentrifiers, which adds a lot of really interesting depth. Adds some layers. I recommend it. I do recommend Hentified.
Yeah. Okay.
Very cool.
They are going to get a second season. We just don't know when.
Right. Everything's like shut down. I started on Epix TV. They have a new adaptation of The War of the Worlds. That's pretty interesting. So I would plug that real quick. I watched the first episode and a half last night. It was really late. So I was like, okay, I have to go to sleep now. So if you like H.G. Wells, you know, War of the Worlds, very modernized and all that appropriate. Oh, my gosh. Y'all hear Hemlock screaming and yelling?
Yeah, no kidding. Release the Hellcats.
Yeah, he just wants to come in. He's not going to, you know, he's just going to wander about and then scream to get back out. also, I'm a little behind on this, but because we just did The Hunt on our one of our previous episodes, Sturgill Simpson has like a cameo in that as a character. And he put out a record called Sound and Fury in October that I had heard like one or two tracks of, you know, but I never really sat down and listened to the whole thing. But it was accompanied by a same day release of a Netflix like anime film that the whole record is set to. And I watched the whole thing this morning. It's like 40 minutes. It's great. The music is fantastic. It's this weird, like, psychedelic country rock blues thing. It's very interesting.
Those are never words I imagine go together.
It was awesome, though. I've seen
those. See, that's like, right up Joshua's alley, though.
Yeah, I love stuff like that. So it was really cool, and the film was really neat. So something, again, you know, if you are bored.
Yeah.
I want to check something out, you know. And he's got a sexy voice, Mr. Sturgill Simpson.
Okay. So
it wasn't a bad listen. Well, you know, the music is very interesting. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a sexy voice. And he, I don't know what that was.
You did a little shimmy, too. That was awesome.
A little shimmy. All right. Anything else? What else is happening, y'all? What else is going on?
I got sucked into because since I was watching The Blob this week on Amazon Prime, I got sucked into Jack Ryan.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like hook, line, and sinker. Like, normally I'm a person who falls asleep at night while watching TV. Like, I can't stay, like, you could not pay me money to stay awake during things. And I am like, eyes wide open, give me more John Krasinski. Like, I am all there for it. And it's kind of terrifying, you know, just how easily money's like changes hands and what you can buy with it and bioweapons and terrorism. It's just super fun stuff. A nice bedtime story. So
is that what it's about? I've not seen any of it.
Yeah. So it's based off of Tom Clancy's books and a character that he writes. And so this guy, Jack Ryan, who John Krasinski plays, is a State Department analyst, but he really works for the CIA. And he basically, they just kind of track people and the money that is kind of changing hands around the world in different, or, and so if there is something that's a little off, because I guess that's the hallmark of terrorism, is like there's money changing hands with people that it shouldn't be changing hands with. So then he kind of gets involved in this terrorist plot and he uncovers like all of this shit happening that wasn't on like their radar. So just about basically like him flying all over the world and dealing with demons and, you know, all that jazz, being a hero, you know, stuff. Ah.
And he, so he's the latest in a long line of Jack Ryan representatives.
Yeah. Was Tom Cruise a Jack Ryan?
No, he was Jack Reacher.
Jack Reacher. Damn it. They're all named Jack.
But
can't we have a Steve? Like a
exactly, Jack Ryan, Alec Baldwin played him in The Hunt for Red October, which is, and Ben Affleck played him in The Sum of All Fears.
Okay, so it's almost kind of like a Bond type.
Basically, it's like low rent Bond. It's like your Kroger version of Bond. You know,
yes, exactly.
And I think Harrison Ford played him in Clear and Present Danger.
Joe, your trivia is on point right now.
I do love a white man secret agent type.
Apparently,
so.
I did also on the Amazon Prime this week watch the movie She-Devil.
Oh, with Roseanne and Meryl Streep.
Oh my God. Hilarious. It is so good. It is like that just gave me the giggles the night I watched that.
Yeah, it's a mess.
It is such a mess. And it's such like Meryl Streep acting in that is just hands down, it's one of my favorite roles she had. Like
it's like girl needed a paycheck and she took it. She cashed that shit. I love the scene where they're like in the indoor pool.
Yes, in the bubble bath. Like they turn the jacuzzi into a bubble bath. Oh my God. She just plays it's so the decadent. Best romance novelist.
Yeah, it's perfect.
It is. It's very, very good. So
yeah, it reminds me of Death Becomes Her, kind of that sort of role.
Yes, but also fantastic.
Sorry, go ahead.
So I've been watching like random commercials, different programs, like, you know, for the last couple of weeks. It kind of like has given me anxiety, like people gathering in a place or like touching. Has anyone else experienced that watching yes. things? It's like, don't touch them. Like I keep instead Absolutely. Of Fright School yelling, don't go down there. I'm like, don't stay 6 feet back. What are you doing? So that's also this week.
I just have that jealousy. I'm like watching concerts and stuff. I'm like, you know, I just, you know, it's just, this was going to be a great year with music and concerts. So it's just kind of a bummer. I'm so selfish. I can't help it.
Such I know you're asshole. You're also boring the shit out of your cat. He just yawned. That. He's like, ah, God.
Yeah, he doesn't.
Another concert. Ah.
Yeah. Anyways. Well, those are all good, fun picks. So people, you know, hey, tell us what you're watching. Send us suggestions or tell us how wrong Joe was on all of his facts just now, if he's wrong. Trivia King.
Trivia King.
All righty. Well, again, we're here chatting with the delightful Delia, and we are going to be right back with her to discuss 1988's The Blob.
That's why I don't have sex. It's not because of my face or my general attitude towards human beings. The thing is that they don't refer to any of these things as murders, which is the most amazing part. It's always referred to as a disappearance. There's fucking blood filling the back of a truck.
That was certainly nice of me, wasn't it, huh?
Same set as Castle Street.
What? Is that really?
No, but I would believe it, actually. That wouldn't shock me. I can't imagine that there's a ton of castles that Charles Band has at his disposal.
That frog is gonna bang Roddy Piper.
Nope, she's just one horny toad.
Justin Long just screamed that he's a fucking walrus for so long.
He keeps yelling cuckoo cuckoo and shit. It's weird.
Join me and Matt as we discuss some of the worst of horror every week on the Horror Movie Night podcast. Listen at hmnpodcast.com.
All right, welcome back. We are still here with the lovely Delia and, of course, Joe. And we're going to talk about...
lovely Joe.
That was a read.
The lovely Joe.
The lovely Delia and, of course, Joe.
Of course.
Jeez. I am nobody's side piece. I am the two-piece and a bit... Okay, I am no one's biscuit.
With honey and butter.
I am a leg and the thigh, girl.
Speaking of biscuits, of white milky biscuits, how is Tidy Whitykins?
Oh, yes. You know what? He's doing fine.
Good,
this is very, like, you know, we're engaging in a very, like, Regency era romance of, you know, long distance.
You're writing each other letters.
Exactly. My
That's
darling.
So nice.
Here's a handkerchief sprayed with my cologne.
Exactly. It's so funny because, like, you know, we're obeying all the orders. We're staying safe. We're, you know, just not going anywhere. And, like, we, like, saw each other the other day where he came over to drop, like, groceries that he had came and brought for the family. Mm-hmm. And he...
To drop, you know, those groceries.
Uh-huh. And he, like, stood there.
Sound like the part of a porn. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, bro, your grocery order. Where do you want me to stick them?
Can I just say that? And so, you know, it was very nice to, like, actually just see him. And
did you, like, talk to him through a window or something, or like?
Well, we like, you know, we kept socially distant, like, you know, okay. the 6 feet apart. But I, you know, not to pivot the conversation because I'm uncomfortable, but there are my friends who are single, who are still on the apps and things. They're saying that, like, people are, like, trying it. They are, like, trying to get people to come over and quarantine and chill. And I'm like, girl, ain't nobody got a 6 foot dick. You know what I'm saying? Like,
not to my knowledge. And I have done the groundwork to verify that.
Yes. I mean, it's just... And I'm just like, why are people doing this? They need to stop. And especially the gays out there. You know, we already got blamed for the last big pandemic. We are not trying to get, you know.
Don't want any part of that. Yeah, it's weird. I've been hollered at by like every Tinder interaction I've had in the last at least year. And they just went, what's going on? How's your quarantine going? I was like, oh my God, is this going to be a thing now? Like,
yes,
you're gonna try to take off my pants via quarantine? No, yeah. Not happening.
It's going to be a thing.
I have an underlying condition of asthma, so I'm not taking the risk.
Yeah, I love it. Good. Don't.
It's certainly not worth it. I can also attest to that.
Okay, so when we invited Delia on today and asked her to pick a movie, she picked The Blob from 1988, but we decided to watch both, so we will kind of talk a little bit about both, but the focus today was the remake.
Yes.
As that was Delia's choice, like yes. Sophie. Delia. So,
and Delia, this is to show how much I love you. Even though the assignment was 88, I went ahead and watched 58 as well,
excellent.
which I never do. I don't do the extra homework. So,
oh, look at
for
you.
I did the extra homework.
Oh,
extra
Joe did the extra credit for Delia.
I want to have a robust conversation, especially since we have to be socially distant. So.
So we are talking about The Blob 1988, directed by Chuck Russell, remake, now that we've spoiled that, it is a remake of a 58 Steve McQueen vehicle. So this one stars Shawnee Smith, Kevin Dillon, Del Close, and a bunch of other who's that of the 80s?
My mom asked me, she's like, who's in that? I was like, exactly.
Right.
I didn't know Steve McQueen was in the original.
You just said you watched it.
No, but like I didn't know that that was like a
Steve before. Wasn't that his film debut? Oh. I think
it might have been his breakout role, but yeah. I don't think it was his first film. Because I had to IMDb that. I was like, is this his first film? And like, no, it's not technically his first film, but it's like where he kind of made a name.
Starring. Yeah, he was
he's smoldered. I'm just saying. He smoldered on that.
He did. He also was like he was like 28 when he was trying to play like what, a high schooler?
A high schooler who looked 40. So
it's like back in the day, like Grease. You know, yes. They all have crow's feet. It's like, I'm a teenager. I've got teenage problems. No.
They got like, so, yeah. You know, we go, to, they get like their rheumatoid arthritis in their hands doing the hand jive, you know?
They're just like shaking it out.
So,
the jive so is actually cruel. Just me trying to get
passing around
back.
Ben Gay. Born to hand jive, baby.
The Blob, if you haven't seen The Blob, it is about a blob from outer space that eats people. So Joe, we'll start with you. What were your feelings toward the 88 version?
I liked it better than From Beyond.
Okay.
So From Beyond we watched with Brennan of the Queer Wolf podcast, and From Beyond it gave me a lot of those vibes, just like how From Beyond and The Thing, that's what I
definitely
got from him. And I think like of those three, if I had to with along those similar types of effects, I put this like slightly above The Thing, but only slightly, because it was
it is much more fun. It's more fun than The Thing. You
it's
know,
more
it's
fun than The Thing. It's not as like desolate as The right. Thing was. And I have to say that I did love, I love like the parts where that were super campy were very campy and landed. And it was just like, I mean, just to have like your quote unquote final girl with like this rifle, just like, you know, Red Sonja on all of them was really great. So yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah. So there you go. I did enjoy it. Will I watch it again? Probably not, but
probably
I did enjoy it.
I enjoyed the rewatch. I hadn't seen it for a very, very long time. I also like how I was reading some kind of pull quotes from the, I don't know if it was Blu-ray or DVD, but they did like a commentary with the directors and stuff. And so they talked about how everybody's like, oh, you know, who's the new Steve McQueen in this film? And they're like, you know, it's set up to be one person. Then it's like Kevin Dillon. But really it's Shawnee Smith. Like if there is one, like she ends up kind of, she's very badass, you know?
Oh yeah. She,
I love her.
Obviously. Which I thought that was such a cool choice to have, like, this, like, straight-laced guy that, what was his name? Paul. Like, that she's going on the date with, and to have him die right away, I did not see that coming.
In this horrific way. You know, he just melted.
Because he was supposed to be your, like, Steve McQueen surrogate, or at least we're supposed to believe, and then he just goes and bites it, and I'm like, ew. Dang.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, because I do want to talk about that, like the differences between the 50s film to deal with like conformity and like nonconformity. But real quick, because Delia chose this, I want to know why this?
Why? This is the first, I guess I should out myself now. I'm not a big horror fan.
That's okay. We've had others.
We've had other people. You know, no one's perfect. That's the whole point of this show.
But this, the whole point, no one's
perfect. We're talking people into loving horror, you know.
What I did, because this is the first film I remember watching that truly terrified me. And I watched it with one of my uncles. And I just remember thinking, like, oh my God, this is number one. I was kind of young, I think, at the time to be watching it, but I'm like, it just struck me as something that had a balance of both terrifying and grotesque, but also like very funny. And so to like juxtapose like this humor of death and dying, I guess, like this blob. Like, you know, kind of in the realm of terrifying things, like something that probably shouldn't be that, like, you know, a jar of jelly. But you add like this score and you add like these different kind of plot points. That's why I had to watch the two films, because I wanted to see the difference between the two. And there was marked difference between the two. But yeah, I just remember being so like, oh my God, like this is like legit scary, but also I'm finding it funny. So that could be occupied in the same space. I just remember thinking that was interesting as an like 11-year-old. So.
I love that. No, and that's great. And that's a fantastic memory. You know, again, here you have you said your uncle showed it to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, more heirloom, more, you know, family passing the horror on.
Exactly.
And horror comedy I do find a lot of horror comedy to not be like, it fails on both for me. You know, but this, I don't know. I have really liked this movie since I was a kid. So I was happy that you brought it up, because I hadn't seen it for a long time. And I was like, oh my gosh, I remember why I like this movie, because it's just so ridiculous and over the top. And I remember, it was funny, I hadn't thought about this in years. And then I was rewatching it and I had this really strong memory. I remember that when we were kids, that we had this giant red comforter that was made of like... It wasn't micro suede, but it was something like that, you know, and like you could like rub your hand across it and kind of change, you know, how the color would be dark or light or whatever. But it was huge, and it kind of had this, it had ripped. And so there was this hole, so you could like crawl into it and you could walk around the house and see the blob.
That is awesome.
Yeah. And so I hadn't thought about that blanket in years. And like sitting and watching this again, I was like, oh my gosh, I remember playing this movie. Like, because that's what we did. We would emulate horror films, like in our, like, you know, play, you know, because we were all pretty close in age, the four siblings the three siblings I have and myself. And so we would like play games like that. And that was that we had this big, gross, like, creepy blanket kind of thing that we could be the blob.
That was the blob.
yeah. So, you know, you get eaten by it and then you're the blob and you eat something else, you know? So anyways, it brought back a nice childhood memory.
I'm not. Nice. That's awesome.
I love when Joshua brings up like beautiful childhood memories related to horror films.
I'm being dissolved in acid.
We played the blob.
It's like a corrosive substance. And I'm like, this is like, okay.
That's like a stomach, kind of. Like, it's like an inside-out stomach is how they kind of describe it, you know? So yeah. The guy who did the blob, who did the work on it, is Lyle Conway, who built the plans for Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the puppetry and stuff of that is by that team. Which I think is interesting. When you watch it, there's stuff that reminds me a lot of Little Shop of Horrors, just in the way it's like set up, like the tentacles and things like that, mm-hmm. And the way it's filmed, especially in the uncut version with the way it's kind of, you know, sometimes you could tell in the film how it's like sort of stuck in there.
Uh-huh.
It's got some of that kind of vibe going on, like a Little Shop does.
Well, and that was the interesting thing between the two monsters, quote unquote, between the 58 and the 88 version, was the 58 blob was just like, I was kind of explaining it to somebody as like if snot and a fruit roll-up had a baby. Like it just was like it was like just like this oozing thing. And the 88 blob, like, obviously, like, had it out for people. And the 58 was just kind of like, oh, we're going to roll over here, and then we're going to roll over here.
We're going to see what's over here.
But, like, the 88 had, like, tentacles and was, like, reaching for people and just, I mean, it was a blob on a mission. So I thought that was definitely interesting. It added more of kind of a terror aspect.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it was gross. You know, it's just so gross. You know, how it melts Paul and then it grabs that kid later. And I remember, like, I think that's one of the probably the earliest horror films that I saw where, like, a child died in, like, a really grotesque manner.
Yeah.
You know, so, so fun.
So fun.
It could get anybody. It can eat anybody.
Dying in a grotesque manner.
Yes, yes, it being dissolved. Like where she puts his arm off of the thing.
Yes! Oh my gosh.
Oh. I was like, man, I wish Joe, I really am sad that we didn't get to see this together, because they're just, you know, part of the joys of doing this show is watching Joe's face when stuff happens. Like, I needed filming of that. Like, I needed a little video of, like, the arm, because I could just see Joe. Ah!
Rips his arm. I texted Joshua when I was watching it, and the part that I texted him at was when they're parking in like their lover's lane and she looks like she's passed out. Well, first of all, he like laces her drink and then, mm-hmm. and then like she's very passed out and, yes. and he's like going to like take advantage of her. And I was like, what? Wild, wild.
Which kind of weird, because that's, what's her name, Erica Eleniak? Is that how you say her name, Eleniak?
Sure.
She's playing Vicky in that scene. Erica.
Why is every that girl named Vicky? I feel like that is the Vicky character.
Or Chrissy or something like that, you know?
Something E.
But, like, I was like, ooh, that's, like, not a good look. And then, you know, the whole stuff in the pharmacy with, like, the condoms and all that. And then, you know, and just, I love this film, too, because, like, the only, like, 80s character actor that we were missing was Edie McClure. Like,
yes.
Like, we had, like, Jeffrey DeMunn, who would end up being, he would be in season 2 of The Walking Dead. We had Art LaFleur, who is, like, you know, he was fucking Babe Ruth in The Sandlot. Paul McCrane, who plays the deputy, he's Dr. Romano on ER for a number of seasons. And then,
that's where that guy is from.
Yes, he was, like, he's just bald and, you know, he has missing an arm. Joe Seneca, who plays the who plays the doctor who is in charge of quarantining the town, he was in Crossroads with Jamie Gertz and Ralph Macchio as like a blues guy. And then, of course, Del Close, which Joshua mentioned, who is like this huge figure in improvisational comedy, yeah. like
oh,
basically.
Really?
Yeah, he like basically invented like the Herald method, and you know, he's a huge. I was like, Del Close, I've heard this name before, and then when I went to go read up about him, yeah. So it's so fascinating to see like all of these, you know, for at the time what would have been like names. And I was like, where is Edie McClure? Is she just going to pop out as like the proprietress of the theater or something?
But then the people behind it, like, you know, Frank Darabont, like, wrote it. He wrote Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, which we are going to do. We're going to do that on an upcoming episode. We're going to eventually get through all the Nightmare on Elm Street films, just for fun. But he also directed The Shawshank Redemption, The Green Mile, and The Mist. Like, he's just, I mean, there's a lot of people on here that would be, like, you know, major figures in, like, you know, horror to come, you know, that were just kind of getting their start, or at least this was kind of a big film that they were working on. Yeah, the thing about the pharmacy, I saw that was one of the things on the, it was like 22 things we learned from listening to the commentary, was that that whole scene was based on something that actually happened to one of the people involved in the production of Discover the Girl's Father. Oh. The father was the pharmacist. That happened to is it that he said? Russell. So Chuck Russell, the director. That happened to him. So fun. I don't know in what way. You know what I mean? Like, was he actually trying to, you know, because gross. But anyways. one second.
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, the cats are still there.
The kitter cats.
They want in and they want out. So what? So some things to talk about then with the film, like, you know, analysis. What is it about? The original gets a lot of communism readings and talking about, like, as we've talked about with The Thing from Another World and kind of those early sci-fi films of the 50s about invasion anxiety, you know, and communism coming for us or some other country bombing us and taking us over. And the newer film is much more. It's more about conspiracy and the government being a villain. So something that, you know, in 30 years, this sort of change from, like, you know, we got to keep, you know, order and keep like the American way of life and blonde, blue eyed, you know, happy times away from, you know, these socialists and these communists that are going to take this from us, to like, oh, the government is creating evil monsters to eat townspeople. It's like this major shift, you know, in thinking, you know, in the era of Reaganomics and all of this. So curious what we think of those
things.
Just throwing those out. That's some of the fun stuff I found that we were that I sent. I sent, you know, there were a couple of articles. Why the Blob is one of the best horror remakes ever, which I do agree that it's really fun. It's a good remake. Mm-hmm. And then there was another one, The Blob versus The Blob, so 58 versus 80.
Yeah. Well, what I found fascinating in the original was the. It was almost, because I'm like, is this supposed to be like a horror movie? Because the theme song for it was, I guess, composed by Burt Bacharach. And I'm like, that sounds like a Burt Bacharach. And it's just so jazzy. And you just, and I'm like, am I supposed, like, are you lulling me into a false sense of security? Or
it made you want to do, like, you know, like a...
Definitely like a swing. Like, I'm like, swing. I'm definitely at a party. Like, the Blob sounds like a really happening guy.
yeah, absolutely.
What I found fascinating about that movie was the kind of young versus old. So, like, you know, this obviously occurs, like, a young person witnesses it. And they spend the entire movie trying to convince this police department that are like, we'll just take care of it tomorrow. Like, they Scarlett O'Hara'd that problem, like, to it just growing exponentially. And I was like, why the ignoring of it? Like, why this kind of just innate distrust between generations? So I didn't like, I mean, I read the articles that you sent, but like, I didn't see, I've seen other things that are very much more communist invading bent. And this just kind of seemed more like generational, like this struggle of like, just pay attention to me. Like, I have something to say. I have ideas.
And well, that kind of like, tracks.
We'll take care of it tomorrow.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to, mean to interrupt women.
Get in there. Would you like to mansplain something to me? That'd be great.
Well, no, I was actually going to support and uplift you.
Oh my God. Can you please compose a song? Support and uplift.
I'll do it to the theme of,
Beneath My Wings.
Exactly. But that's interesting, right? So I'm so glad that you brought that up, Delia, about the idea of like the generational conflict of like young people versus older people, because 3 years, so 3 years prior to 1958's Blob, we have in 1955 a social commentary film called Blackboard Jungle that comes out, which is a film about teachers in an interracial inner school. Sidney Poitier is in it. and it's credited as being one of... And it's credited as one of being one of the films that kind of kicked off this this emerging kind of youth culture and what youth culture is. So prior to this, like the youth, there is no youth culture. There's adults, and then that's it. Like all culture is for adult people. And then you have subsequently, you have Blackboard Jungle, and then like as teenagers, as boomers' children grow up, right, we have those that being the beginnings of like emerging youth culture, and you have like Rebel Without a Cause and all of these things where like misunderstood youth. So it totally tracks in my mind of like that, because who's going out to like watch these films in a drive-in? I mean, my first knowing anything about The Blob was seeing it in the background of Grease. The movie Grease, when they're at the drive-in.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so they're watching The Blob as that's going on. So I'm just like, oh, okay. And it's so interesting in that regard. So to see it from a lens of like youth culture in terms of, you know, which plays a lot into a lot of films, is like choosing to disregard the warnings of children, even though, because supposedly the adults know better.
Yeah.
And that's always been one of my favorite tropes in media, is because it's like, well, maybe as someone who was, you know, for a long time, one of the youngers trying to, you know, shake a fist at the olds, quote unquote, like it makes total sense. And then, you know, you apply that to the current circumstance that we're all finding ourselves in, where it's like this, you know, we're trying very hard to like tell people to like stay inside, and you know, it's like the different generations are at war with each other almost on a daily basis, where it's like millennial children telling their boomer parents to stay home, and Gen Z's out and like having spring break in Florida and all that stuff. So, so to see this from, to see 1958's Blob as a function of like youth culture is very interesting. So thank you for bringing that up, Delia.
Oh, you're welcome, Joe. Anytime.
I agree. I don't think that they really set up. And I think the director even said, by using that kind of funny, silly song at the beginning, it's like, this isn't a horror film. Like, we're having fun. It's supposed to be campy. It's supposed to be silly. You know, and then it was a big hit. It made a ton of money. And Steve McQueen probably kicked himself all the way to the bank for not taking the original deal.
Oh my God, I love him.
This is her now. Now she's
her. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So I love these cats. She's like, pardon me.
I know, right? He didn't think it was going to be, Steve McQueen didn't think it was going to be a hit, you know, so then it went off and made, you know, $4 million or something at the time. It was a huge, huge take. $4 million on a $110,000 budget. And so.
And you know what's weird about like the campiness of it? It's never like, the acting in it is so one of the articles explained it as wooden. And it was so like serious. And it's like, so is this supposed to be fun? Like, it's almost like you're afraid to be like laughing at it because everyone is taking it so seriously.
It's got like a slowness to it too. Like there's that scene where they run to the people's house and like the guy's talking. I don't know. I wish I would have written down what he was saying because it just takes forever. It's like, there's something happening. There's something happening. There's something happening out there. Is there something happening? Something's going on. And it just goes on. Like the whole movie's like that, you know? So yes. I don't know. I think it functions. It like that's why it works is because, you know, I mean, again, I think it could use some editing because of that kind of the length of time that it takes, even though the movie's not that long. It just feels longer than it is in moments because it's like, yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes. Something is
something's happening. We all agree. Let's do something about the something that's happening.
The gag where like the civil defense air horn is going on. The guy goes to put his hat on and then it's like, that's the fire truck. And he puts his, I don't know how to dress for this.
Well, that they all like congregated in like a specific place of people like honking horns.
And so I'm like, Steve McQueen, how small they is all this knew
town?
They all knew to go to that, to like that little hardware that store, wherever he was.
Supermarket. And yeah. I just love like the scene. I was like just beside myself, church giggling about this, when the blob envelops the diner and they're in the basement and their demise is certain. And outside, like the fire chief and the police, like the head of police, like are staring at the diner and they're just like, well, they're going to die. There's nothing we can do about it. I was just like, oh my God. Like, not even any like Russian to save them. Like, nothing like, you know, I was just flummoxed by like, yep, that's happening right now.
They are. They're going to, that's going to happen.
They're going to die. Yeah.
You know, those are some good kids, you know?
Those are some good kids. Good kids. They're going to die. But, you know.
So I do like that reading. Again, I think that because of like the time frame and, you know, a lot of invasion movies get that sort of read just because of the time period. Mm-hmm. I do think that makes sense that this is kind of more about like that generational distrust that was very prominent and you see in a lot of films of that time. And you see within a lot of like documentaries at the time or people talking about that time of like, you know, this things were changing so rapidly for young people and creating that. Their own distinct lives away from their family. I mean, you know, we were seeing more and more, you know, music and films and things being made and directed at young people in a way that had never happened before. So I like that reading. So then into the 88 version, we've dropped, I think having the Paul character die so early is kind of a real, like, yeah, this guy's not going to save the day this time. We need the punk rocker on the motorcycle with the long hair. And like he's, you know, so it's a very different take, obviously, and something that speaks more to, I think, the 80s and 80s culture and, you know, films like The Lost Boys. And you're getting more of this like, you know, punk rock kind of aesthetic.
More of an anti-hero than like the Letterman jacket. Like
exactly.
Hero.
Yeah, precisely. And to fight something that's different because this movie, you know, misdirects in the sense that we see it land, you know, the same old dude comes out and finds the blob and
poking it with a stick. We've been doing it for millennia, apparently.
That is the way that you do things. When you find an alien, Delia, you are going to, you're just going to feel.
I'm going to suddenly, there's going to be a stick to my right and I'm going to grab it.
Yeah, it'll be your first thought. what is this? And, you know, so we think it's the same story, you know, that, hey, it's, you know, it's an alien, it's landed on here and it's fucking vicious and hungry. And then towards, you know, the, you know, end of the film or about midway through or so, you find out, oh, no, the government made this and has fucked it up like they do everything in the cynical realm of the 80s that we're living in within this film. And they've decided that this town is expendable and fuck all these people. And I love how there aren't many people of color in this film at all. And the main black gentleman is the villain. Fuck all these people. Fuck all of them. They're expendable. I'm like, wow. Wow.
See, if they were to remake this now, it would be Samuel L. Jackson, and he'd be like, fuck you, Whitey. Like, that's what it would have been.
Which, you know, we can read it that way. It's like, hey, they thought our lives are expendable. These motherfuckers are expendable. Let the blob eat them. Small town America, fuck them. Yeah. They're racists anyways. No.
Just take them off the map.
But I mean, you know, the message that sends, that the government is represented, interestingly enough, here by this black man who's like, ah. Save our weapon.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I just found that interesting.
And then subsequently, the person who, like, has the equipment with which to save everybody is another black gentleman with a truck. with the ice truck.
That is true, with his CO2 or whatever it is, that the nitrogen,
liquid nitrogen.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I failed at science.
Girl, you and me both. I'm like, it's a giant truck of ice, right?
It's so fascinating because it's like it instills that kind of distrust of institutions that was so prevalent in 80s culture by making the government be ultimately at fault for everything that's happening, but also at the end, religion also being the undoing as well.
Yes.
Yeah, that he has the control. He's like weaponized this thing, you know, or may in the future. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
May in the future. And like also his entire, like, he's this, like, you know, kind of like fiery brimstone backwoods preacher, but like everyone in that tent is black. Like they're all people of color.
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's a good point.
And it sorry, kind I just of love what I've
I love found- this cat.
No, go ahead, Delia. I know. Sorry, I can't.
You can't, like, you know, they're sick of being quarantined too.
Yeah, they are.
But the kind of immediate, when you have an entity like the government or the military, how you can, like, set it up to be this kind of big monster because it is just like a conglomerate, and how you can immediately. And I think this filmmakers did a great job in distinguishing, like, the us versus them. Like, they show up in the white hazmat suits. And so immediately, like, you have this, like, entity, even though you don't have to say, like, it's the government, like, you know, like, that's part of the issue, or that's part of, you know, this is clearly, like, an us versus them.
We saw E.T. We know what's going to happen.
We know what's going down now.
The visual language of it, though. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I just – and also, like, the opening credits of the 88 block. Like, I just felt like that did such a service because I'm like, God, there was none of that in, like – I think just 50s and 60s movies in general, like, the way credits rolled out. Because in the 88, like, you look like you're going into, like, a desolate town anyway. And then to find out everyone's at a football game. And, you know, everyone kind of floods back into the town after that, like, slice of Americana is over. So, yeah. But it sets it up as, like, oh, this town's empty anyway, so who cares? Like, it can be knocked down and start again. But it's like, oh, the vibrancy is at the football field.
And to change it from, like, what, Pennsylvania to California, right? Like, to have that change of location be also just because, again, you can't just have any movie with, like, a rebel like that take place in, you know, it has to take place in California. We have to capitalize on surf culture. It was definitely, I have to agree, I did read the article that Joshua
Joshua, I know, I tried to said. Do my homework.
just things to think about, you know.
And I do think that this is, like, this is right up there with The Ring as far as remakes go, for me. Because The Ring is still my number one just because of how they were able to tell the similar story but also adapt it to culture, because it had the added layer of, like, being two different cultures and not And not so far removed in time, the two different films, Ringu and Ring. And with this one, it's just like, it's, you know, 30 years later after the release of the original, it's still in Cold War times towards the end, but they didn't know that at the time, still in Cold War times. And it's so, and just to see also like technology wise, to see how it, see what they were able to do and all the restrictions on censorship that were lifted in just that 30 year period was interesting. And the version that they have on Amazon is the Criterion Collection for the 58 version. And so it looks, the blob in that one looks almost exactly identical to the blob that's in 88, like the color and everything. So I thought that was really cool to see, to see how those still kind of were true to each other.
I agree. But, yeah.
And to have it speak to that particular time, which will be interesting when we finally get to see the Candyman remake that's coming out, hopefully, knock on wood, later this year, to see how it speaks to similar but also more modern issues.
But the same issue, that's the thing, you know, like you bring up the Cold War and our anxieties around that, our invasion anxieties, our you know, feeling threatened, our culture feeling threatened, and how we're on two ends of the spectrum with it, and how much like the cynicism or how much awareness of, you know, we're kind of pawns. Like I like what dealing what you were talking about, the government. It's interesting that the government is also a blob. You know, it's this amorphous entity that we don't really quite, we don't trust. We don't know its motivations, you know, within film, you know, it's always that kind of thing where it's moving. And so it's interesting to see that the change, you know, this, the cynicism or the more of awareness of like, well, the government's going to do what it's going to do in that 30 years. And I think with Candyman, you know, the film coming out in the early 90s and sort of our awareness around issues of race then and where we are now, as, you know, the conversation, it'll be very interesting to compare, you know, that sort of that dynamic. And I think that's what we had the opportunity to do that with the blob and Cold War, you know, propaganda, as you will. So I think that's a great point. Look at this like deep conversation we're having about a blob.
Well, and it's interesting then too, like going back to invasion anxieties and what's happening now in our culture, mm-hmm. and a virus invading us.
Right.
And how we don't have like a specific, I mean, the blob obviously was an entity kind of like swallowing people up, but now we have this like invisible invader, which I would imagine is its own umbrella of invasion anxiety, is that you have this thing that you don't know. If you're infected, you don't know, like, you know, who's infected or what you just kind of like, there's just a heightened then anxiety around basically like something you can't control.
Oh, 1,000%.
Figure out how to like fight it.
Yeah. And we're seeing with social media all the same things, you know, we're seeing people come up, oh, the government made this. Oh, it's coming from China, which is, you know, its own form of anxiety and its own mm-hmm. form of like another place creating something to destroy us all. Or, you know, the government has created this, or some evil scientist has created this, or, oh no, it came from the gays. It came from, you know, like, cause we're being blamed for COVID-19 as well. You know,
evil, so it's Asian scientist gays. That's what's exactly. happening here.
That's what's happening.
There is a gay Asian scientist that works for our government who does not feel safe right now.
Right.
You're right. One guy.
But yeah, so it's just, you know, it's interesting to see how that our fear, how we react, you know, and how we respond to things. It doesn't change much.
No, it doesn't at all. But then it also has managed to completely upend our culture. Like,
oh, absolutely. 100%.
Like, yep. It's a complete 180, like, how we are tasked to do things differently now. So, you know, that, like, well, here we are, all the final girl. Like, we're surviving. But, like, you know, you have to find – so then it's, like, why do we have all of this anxiety to begin with if, like, we're fighting something in real time? You know what I mean? Like, why do – like – we kind of like get anxious about not nothing, like clearly it's a thing, but I think we build it up so much in our mind when it's like, well, here we are dealing with it. Like,
well, because it's still unknown. We don't have a definitive, you know, like there's no answer, and that's the thing. And we might not get one, you know, we might not, you know, ever know. So I think that's always, I think, where that anxiety comes from. It's all rooted in that, in fear of the unknown, in fear of death. You know, we are not a morbid creature together. You know, we're not, we like to focus on youth. We like to focus on life. We like to focus on living, and we get up every day as if we're going to live forever. And we do things that we plan, you know, we make plans as if we know really what tomorrow will bring. You know, I spent, I don't know how much money on concerts, my whole calendar for March, every single week I had a show, and it's like, fuck you, you know, and it's like all of that is gone, you know what I mean? And that's just my one little tiny calendar of things in a sea of millions of people who made plans and plan to go places and do things and see people. And now it's like, fuck you, you know? So it's just, the anxiety of having our entire like way of life that is built. The other thing I was going to say about this film, it also made me think The Blob is like sort of that conformity and like within the 80s, this age of excess, of want, of need, of crave, of I have to have. You know, that our whole world is built on that. And that's all pulled out from under us now. You know, we can't buy anything. We can't get anything delivered. We can't, or, you know, all the things that we've been taught to want to do and to have those serotonin, you know, dopamine, whatever, you know, payoffs is gone. And so it's like, sit at home and read or watch TV. I think it's very anxiety inducing for people.
Well, yeah, because I think we have this built in busyness with jobs and hobbies, and like, we never have to like actually sit with ourselves. Yeah. And I think this is now causing like this other horror of like, oh shit, like now I have to actually like be present with
this
myself.
Existential dread.
Yeah, exactly. Like everyone's like having a dark night of the soul simultaneously. It's like, oh boy.
Can I just be with myself? No.
Well, I mean, you know, if we're going to go there, right? If we're going to get real and go there.
Let's go there, girl.
Like, you know, I've been in this new budding.
Some people got to do. They can listen to this go on for 3 hours.
I've been, you know, navigating this new relationship that, you know, that I find myself in. And it's been very interesting to have to navigate this as well. And having gone from like seeing him every week, almost every day for the last, you know, few months to not being physically present, you know, is very difficult. And it's very, it's been very difficult, and it's been interesting, but it's also like, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, well, we, you know, this is something that we know we have to do, and we're, you know, it's forcing people to really kind of define what the important parts of their life are. When you have to, when you are being told, and the safest thing you can do is to, you know, stay put and just only see you know, virtually see people or all that, it really kind of, you know, taking that time to use the anxiety to kind of refocus and say, okay, well, I know that these things are the things that are important to me now. Which is, you know, has been an interesting exercise for me as someone who is like very anxious. So, you know, to kind of reframe it in that way. But yeah, I mean, I, as a person who is like out almost every night, you know, doing something, working my trivia job, or, you know, spending time seeing people, being that extrovert who like is recharged by seeing people. Mm-hmm. This has been very, this has been a different way to deal with that. And, you know, also allowing people to have grace with others in terms of like, you know, oh, you know, I reach out to the people that I reach out to, but I also make space when people reach out to me, even if I've not, reached out to them first, just because it's like, if you're reaching out because you're looking for something, you're trying to make that connection, I'm going to be there. But it's been interesting to see those things play out as well. And on a kind of like, you know, on a gay bitch petty note, it's interesting because like when people try to make plans with you to do like a virtual happy hour or to like watch a thing together or just to talk or whatever, it's interesting because it's like no one should be going anywhere. So it's like, oh, I can't make that. And I'm like, okay, well, what are you doing? I almost want to be like, what the hell are you doing that you can't make this, that you can't do this?
Yeah, and
I just didn't want to hang with you. Sorry.
Yeah, Joe. Exactly. I still just don't want to hang out.
Well, you know, it's just
even
so funny.
Even though I have all the time and technological capability, I still just don't want to see your ass. That's it.
Yeah. And like seeing and people being very honest about like the boundaries that they have. So like, you know, I was trying to meet up. I was interested in meeting up with some friends from work and saying like, hey, who's going to do this? Who, you know, is anyone going to be on this Zoom call, you know, on this day? And someone was like, you know, I've spent most of my days these days are like Zooming with people and being in front of screens and like needing to get away from that. And it's so interesting because it's like, okay, well, I, as someone who's this extrovert, I need to see people. So I only can do that in front of a screen and trying to like, you know, navigate all of that too. So, you know, we'll see how it goes with, you know, again, this has been your COVID takeover of the podcast.
I think it's fair points though.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just, you know, because we're all in it together, like, I think that's been the interesting thing. It's not just affecting one segment of the population. It's not just affecting old and young. It's affecting all of us and how we live and work and how we share space and especially like relationship wise. Like, I can't even imagine like being in a new relationship and having that like distance automatically enacted when such like a huge part of that beginning is the newness of like being in physical contact with somebody. And then to have that be like, I'm going to like press my hand against the glass and you're going to press your hand against the glass and we're just going to like share a moment and leave my groceries and that's it.
Yeah. That's been, you know, we'll hopefully one day we'll look back on this and, you know, with fond memories of, and, you know, romanticize it more than it was and, you know, completely gloss over.
We're definitely good at that.
Yeah. And completely gloss over about how like, you know, utterly devastating it is to the psyche. But, that's been an interesting thing, but I've also like, you know, I like the idea that I'm spending all this time, like I'm at home with my parents. So I'm like spending all this time with them and, you know, trying to still navigate things around, you know, all of that. And yeah, it's been an interesting time. I didn't mean to take over.
No, by all means.
Great points.
And I think it's good for people to have that commiseration, you know, and to know like, hey, this isn't easy for everybody. Like, you know, some of like, I actually really kind of, I still have to go to work. So because I work for, you know, as an extension of the hospital, so we're all still going to work. So I, you know, part of me is very jealous because we had Friday off for Cesar Chavez and I'm like, oh, awesome. Cause I just laid around and watched TV and I've been reading and I've been catching up on all this stuff. Cause I can't go anywhere, can't do anything. Nobody can come over. So there's no real distraction to like focus on reading and writing and doing things. And I'm like, gosh, this is really nice. I probably could do this for a week. I couldn't do it for a month though. You know? So I think people that have been, I mean, gosh, how long has this gone on now? I think somebody said they've been in their house since the 12th. So 18 days.
Yeah. I was laid off Nevada's different. Like we haven't had a shelter in place order or anything, but like in effect, because all the bars are shut down, all gaming is shut down, all like, so we have like supermarkets open and that's about it. And also contractors, there's some interesting like essential businesses, and that's been fascinating learning what essential and non-essential businesses is, because my roots would like to say that hairdressing is an essential business, yet the state of Nevada is like, no, no, girl, not essential. No,
we're going to leave the weed store open.
Exact. Cannabis, essential business. But it's just interesting that I'll keep the roots, I guess. Let me get high.
It's the 80s. It's in time with
time with our discussion of the blob. But I was laid off on the 13th, I think, of March, Friday the 13th. And they, in effect, that whole next week, shut everything down. Like the entire – they had one case of coronavirus, I think, at the Mirage. And after that, like, I mean, it happened quick. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, if it was going to happen, it was going to be everybody had to make that, you know, they had to all probably be on board.
Well, and I think that's why we have – we don't have as many cases as we could have if we kept the casinos open longer.
Oh yeah.
But I think definitely the writing was on the wall with that they're like, shut it down.
So. Well, yeah. And that is tough, because that is a very, you know, different place to be in, you know, like I said, like we still, you know, because of my type of employment, you know, I still have a job and I don't have to worry about the concerns of that. So, you know, I hope that things return to normal soon, so people can go back to, you know, or at least having, because that's a different kind of anxiety, obviously. You know, it's one thing to be like, oh, I have to be at home. It's another thing to be like, oh, I'm home, but I also can't make money, or I can't do this, or I can't do that, you know? So that's a whole other level. So, you know.
We're all kind of in it. So, I mean, it's not like it's just affecting certain people, but it is. I was talking with a friend this morning about in like the grief of things not taking place, like not being able to go to concerts, not being able to like I know friends who have their kids, it's their senior year and they're not going to be able to graduate take part in all those like bullshit things you do your senior year, which seems so important at the time. But then looking back, you're like,
right.
But to have that taken away and to be able to, or to be able to kind of pivot and do things creatively to like, be able to take up that slack of like, okay, I'm missing this, but I can do this in its place. So yeah, I've been kind of overwhelmed with like, God, like people are really like, you know, singing happy birthday to people from the street, and neighbors having happy hour at their trash cans, and like staying 6 feet apart. Like, I mean, it's just people are finding like creative ways to still connect.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's us as humans. We're always going to find some way, because we're all social animals, to connect.
Yes, that has been one of the good things to come out of this is just a reminder, like we are not the monsters that our media sells us. You know, we're actually pretty cool in a lot of ways, and there's been a lot of really cool stuff to come out of that. So, well, I think that is a good place to wrap that up, because that's a nice thought. You know, we're better than we like to think we are.
Yeah,
Let's keep that going. this has been a delight. So again, you can follow Delia's exploits with Joe on MFK Ultimate. I keep wanting to call it Ultra, and I don't know.
Me too.
That's so like, weird.
Yeah, I'm like, I almost did it again.
I didn't want to say Ultra because it has like a military, like assassin type of, you know, kind
Ultimate
of connotation.
Has like a more American gladiator.
Exactly.
Ultimate. Yeah.
Ultimate.
But MFK Ultimate on all the streaming platforms, or all the podcasting platforms, I'm sure. Wherever you find Fright School, you'll be able to find MFK Ultimate. Delay, this has been a delight. Thank you so much. I hope that you'll come back and
I would love
chat with
to.
Us again.
Yes. This was so much fun.
Yeah, this has been very, very fun. I highly recommend, dear listener, that you go to the Jersey Ghoul Facebook page. Actually, it might also be on Fright School's page. But rewatch our Horror Hound Happy Hour video, because it was a lot of fun. There was a lot of really good conversation in it. So, you know, if you're bored and need to waste an hour or whatever it was, however long it was very entertaining. There was some cool conversation. Do that. Otherwise, hope you're liking us, following us on all the social medias. Give us some reviews, give us some stores. And Joe, I'm just going to look at you for a moment.
This is like weird eye contact.
I'm going to reach out. I miss you. I miss having you in the studio.
I miss being there, Joshua. I miss all of you.
Yeah.
Delia, I'm used to missing her because she lives so far away.
So far.
And, you know, to be quite honest, we have MFK Ultimate is to thank for me learning the platform in which we're able to do this, like, remote recording. I thank Delia for allowing me that opportunity. I think it just goes to show that, you know, it just goes without saying, I should say, that we all miss each other and being in each other's presence and
absolutely,
you know, being fun and queer and
exactly
in the same
together.
Room.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, I hope no scary acid dissolving blobs invade your nightmares anytime soon. And
hopefully the jelly snot blobs of the 58 version.
Yes, if nothing else. Yes, that's fun. The raspberry jam. Alrighty. Well, good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davy Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.
Ha 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 ha